Inside AC is part of Khadir Galleria Anticamera, a cultural programming project that encourages critical thinking and debate about architecture. Through radio broadcasts, artist residencies, workshops, and exhibitions, the project explores architecture in its broadest and most holistic sense. With a focus on community and integration, Anticamera seeks to foster dialogue between architectural practices, visual arts, institutions, and society, creating a shared space that promotes experimentation and participation. Inside AC showcases these intersections and provides a new auditory perspective on Anticamera's exhibitions, workshops, or installations. Today, in the third part of this series, we have Nithia Iyer and Vlad Mazyko. They will be talking about their work in An Experiment in Intervals 3, Violet Desert. This exhibition describes the site of an industrial park in Barreiro, Portugal, through the lens of monstrous architecture. Shaped by the industrial expansion brought about by Companhia União Fabril, the site exists in a liminal zone. It is haunted by the promises of economic prosperity and the failure of such promises.
This site does remind me of that sort of concept and some of the Turan Vague that he writes about. And so there's something about, I think, your use of this space for that. Do you see this as actually a political work?
I think we have different views on it. We end up being attracted to spaces, or at least for me, I like that the space has come undone in some way, because that for me is the slippage. I like that the spaces, both the spaces we've worked in for the interval series, have been slightly dilapidated, as we said. So a material shift is underway, and therefore it creates space for another shift. And the emptiness and the lack of bodies means that the strength and the way that the space might codify bodies is weaker. As you said, in a government building, there's lots of bodies that are following the codes of that architecture and that ideology, so there's less space for you to mess with it. So in terms of it being a political work, and it's interesting because somebody asked us recently if we thought that the idea of the interval could change things in the world. I think the political aspect is just to highlight that politics is also a fiction that's been materialized, and everything that we live in was an idea, you know, and that it's not singular and it's not an objective truth until the arrow of time makes it as such. And so that the plurality is sort of always there. And just the same way that, you know, during a film when an interval happens, or during a play, the interval is specifically when the play is not happening. And so there are moments where, even if it's just through your mind and hopefully through your presence, you can actualize that your surroundings are also a manifestation of an idea that isn't absolute.
And in a way it brings us maybe to the work, which is a set of thousands of images run through a machine at high speed. And so it's a physical thing, isn't it? It's a film. So can you say a little bit about the title, Violet Desert?
Yeah, the thing that we're kind of looking at now is the residue of the pyrite, which kind of has these like elements of violet in it. When we came onto the site, especially like this structure here, that's in front of us, which is kind of these archways, very much reminded me of the beginning of Red Desert, Antonioni's film about a female protagonist who's not coping within her environment. So that film kind of became the inspiration for how we chose to interact with this site, and how we chose to kind of reimagine a different future or a different way of being for this protagonist.
Specifically, her site that she was in is a highly industrial site. It was Antonioni's first colour film, and it was very gratuitous with the industrial site and its effluves and its noises and the alienation of this woman within it.
And he uses colour a lot in kind of representing people's internal worlds and their kind of existential angst. In homage to that film, we decided to call it Violet Desert, particularly kind of because of this, the colour of this pyrite, which is almost like luminescent kind of.
It's incredible colour, isn't it? It almost reminds me of photographs of Robert Smithson's spiral jetty work in the States, which has this reddish algae that grows over it. So there's sort of a reference sort of there to another site-specific work.
Yeah, the algae here is almost the copper deposits, which kind of form these little, like, jewel-like turquoise within the pyrite, which is also quite beautiful. I like this kind of thing of that it's, you know, potentially toxic and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely toxic. Yeah. But I mean, the thing with the violet, though, and it's funny because it doesn't come out in the work as clearly, but you can see it when you're here live that there's like the mauve of the pyrite fields, and then you can see these little glimmers of UV, of the violet, ultraviolet kind of colours upon it. And you can only see that when you're here live. And there's, again, it's that there's an interaction. And it's funny because in Antonioni's work, he doesn't actually have a red desert.
In terms of sound, we referenced the beginning of the film where the credits are going, and actually it's at the end of the film where you have this kind of slightly unhinged operatic singing, and which Nithya tried to kind of emulate while she was singing in one of these large kind of bin cauldron
drums. Yeah, we'll go there now.
To create that sense of like eerie echo. We've used that, and then Antonioni also starts to use a lot of like electronic sounds just to kind of create this kind of atmosphere again of something that's slightly like uncomfortable or unhinged. The cello also has this capacity to kind of be slightly eerie and uncomfortable at times and edgy, but at the same time it provides these quite smooth, warm tonal sounds. We're quite optimistic in this kind of in this version of Giuliana, the character of the film. We're kind of again, reimagining a potential future for her, and I think the cello provides like some kind of warmth.
If you think about the start of the Red Desert, the Antonioni, there's a sort of working soundtrack which is all about machinery working and smokestacks and the belching of smoke and steam. And your film, in contrast, has got this amazing soundtrack that is sometimes, well, it's very beautiful, but sometimes it's almost a lament. Sometimes it's distressed and taut. And so I wondered about, do you feel a nostalgia for the workings of the factory?
Antonioni often, when he's asked about the film, says that he's not criticising modernity, even though that's kind of like the first thing that you want to go to when you see the film. In fact, he talks about how he finds factories or industrial buildings quite beautiful. Especially in this scenery where it was filmed in Ravenna, he talks about the beauty of the structure of the smokestack as compared to like the banal forest that's on the other side that's all kind of the same shape.
I think this idea of the nostalgia, I mean, yes, from the Second World War onwards, these promises were being made and, you know, utopias and economic miracles happened. And then even whilst they were breaking down, they were still being promised to children of the 70s and 80s and 90s of, you know, you work hard, you be a good person, you be a good citizen, you input into the economy and things will come for you. And I think now with, you know, the situation of multiple crises in the world, you can really see that that's not the case. The nostalgia is for the promise. And the promise that even as we are dislocated and alienated, we still kind of
yearn
for it because it's a belonging. It's the fairy tale that was told to you.
There's one shot in the film where it catches your face, and there's an echo to Giuliana there, a very strong echo, I think, which is a really nice moment.
Interestingly, so this is something that Nithya didn't want included, and yet it was one of the only, I think it was an accidental kind of filming that I got her, you know, like turning around. And it's just like a moment, maybe like you said, of disbelief or something not being in the right place. And I very much wanted to include that because it gives, for a moment in the entire kind of film, it gives a very like human element. For a moment, the landscape is out of the picture. It's just her. In terms of, you talk about nostalgia, we've had like many people kind of comment on the almost analog quality of Violet Desert. So I think our nostalgia kind of seeps through in the film. I come from a background of photography, And so the camera is always positioned. It's quite photographic. I don't necessarily ever follow Nipia. It's still, you have the background of you know, the violet desert, and then you have Nitya kind of moving in it, and the frame never kind of follows her. It's always quite like a still landscape.
Because it's structured into three chapters, it might be useful to talk about each chapter in turn.
So chapter one is, yeah, very much the reference to Antonioni. It sets up the protagonists being the figure of the female, and the industrial park being the other protagonist, and then how they interact. And here we are referencing Giuliana in the movie, and this kind of this imposition of the environment, of the landscape on her, and the alienation.
In that first chapter, it was when I said earlier that there was things that we tried to do on the site and it overpowered us, that in the end, what was the most sort of the best articulation of the feeling of the site was actually that sort of despondency with which I'm walking through. And it made me, upon reflection and seeing the work now, really think about this. Again, generations later, here we are, you know, with those promises behind us. And there's still that dislocation, and there's still that lostness of this figure walking through in boots and a coat, sort of apparently ready for something, but with clearly no purpose, no place within the site, and this sense of pointlessness, or, yeah, as I said, this despondency.
And there's a sense of the power relationship in chapter one. It's very much the site is the big player here. Mm. And then it's about how you can start to negotiate yourself within this landscape, how you can start to respond and create something about yourself in a way, how as an artist you can then actually respond to a site and create a work within this landscape.
Actually, if you put your head inside and make a sound inside the drum, you can hear where I was singing.
So in here is where we sang, or I sang, and in that first chapter you see half my body has disappeared inside this drum.
As the work progresses, so in chapter two, there's something that you're doing to do with time, which is fascinating in relation to the site, but also something to do with a struggle, I think. There's a sort of two-sided aspect to chapter two, and these two sort of concepts that you're developing, and through the movement, but also through the camera work as well. Can you say something more about that sort of sense of time and reversal of time?
What ended up coming out in chapter two was that this is it's both of those things simultaneously. Like, how do you show both the progress of time and that unbecoming being the becoming of, I think also partly through a frustration of not knowing how to interact with the site, and having this tension that didn't, there was nothing to almost bounce off, everything being so dead and vast, and that it ended up conjuring in the body this, you could only bounce off yourself and understand that the tension was something you held in yourself. But for us, it's quite a controlled struggle. It's a specific struggle that is happening within these gestures and these actions, and it's a struggle from which one doesn't recover without composition. There is a decorum with which the body recovers itself. And yeah, I think that temporality of things both going forwards and backwards, and that they're then creating this liminal space of openness between them, was really key for that.
Also, this is the chapter that really speaks to the kind of the monstrosity, and monstrosity kind of being that liminal space between the first chapter, where we're kind of introducing this alienation, and then the last chapter of the interval, and monstrosity again being the place where the kind of the potential for transformation not necessarily being progressive, but maybe being also regressive in a particular way. And I think that's with the loops that we play with, and again, to kind of maybe distort this sense of a linear time.
I don't know if we were thinking about it specifically as an identity as much as I almost want to say like a hyper object, this thing that emerges from the shedding of the jacket, and it's a self birth in a way, and you see the head sort of trying to push out, and the struggle and then this relief, but that after the relief of birthing yourself, there is this confusion. And I think that we're in this place now, as not just as a generation, but, you know, as a kind of contemporary culture, where we can see these mistakes and we can see the things that need to be reversed or the things we need to birth ourselves from and rebirth at what our identity is. But we are mired as well in this confusion. There's this thing of, what do you do the day after the revolution? Nobody knows. And I think it's interesting that that's the part where, first of all, you see a figure that doesn't have a face. And that's intentional. And actually in my own personal art practice, but also like lots of feminist art practices, historically I've used the face covered in hair or the sort of headless figure, particularly of the woman, to denote not just this undoing of the woman, but this ability of transmutation and this openness and this slightly intimidating and slightly, morbid moment of this death birth, And that I think it's interesting that it's after that my face gets shown, despite my willingness, because there's a confusion there. And that's, I think, also where the hopefulness, and there's a kind of caution there. In that sense, I don't think either of us have thought about that it's specifically, I think that it's a woman's body is like, there is just a different context to that, but that we haven't thought specifically about the other cultural factors of that body. It's our body, body of the viewer and the film. It's all of our body. It's the body of the site. It was this playfulness that we had on the site after we both felt this immense sense of relief after that scene of the body battling to come out of the coat, and then we were just kind of playfully saying like, oh, what if we did this? And I was almost actually thinking of it, after you give birth, and then like it's almost like you threw your placenta over, it's a kind of weird thing, but it's like, oh, I don't need this anymore. And this thing, this that has so much, I mean, the coat with the lapels and everything, it has such a strong relationship to a particular time and a particular role. And it's, this plasticky kind of shine, the leathery shine on it. And that it's useless. That it's just, shed skin.
It's kind of biggest reference to Juliana. I mean, if we were to kind of draw a caricature of her, it would be her in that green coat in the beginning of the film and at the end of the film. And this is where she is most kind of out of place in her environment. Like in the first scenes of Red Desert, there's this greyness, and then here she is with her auburn hair and green coat. And so that coat is again, it's an ode to the Antonioni film. And then when Nithya kind of lets go of it, we kind of also let go of, I guess, what Antonioni imagines for Juliana. So this is the part where we go into, what we imagine for her.
So chapter three then is called the interval. Can you say just a little bit about how you're thinking about the notion of interval?
So this chapter actually is the only one that has a date on it, which is the date that we filmed the interval. So even though we're playing with this kind of time, leaking into space leaking into time, we do want to demarcate this moment of timelessness. I mean, the interval is actually the part that we're kind of leading towards, and the part that we wish to experiment with.
We tried multiple times to catch this slippage, and we thought that it was guaranteed in so many of the more kind of overtly, sort of, for want of a better word, like grotesque parts of the site, the more dilapidated, the more striking parts. And the entire time we'd been walking past this flatness, this vast emptiness of the desert. And it was only sort of by chance, again, when we were experimenting and playing with running around and moving on the site, that we realized that this vastness was a protagonist.
It's an amazing assertion of, there's something about free will in it, and I think it's the power relationship that I was talking about earlier to do with in chapter one, and how it leads to chapter three. In a way, the body has power in this instance, and it's about a slightly abandoned set of movements in a way of just the enjoyment of repetitive movement, and there's something really liberated about it that takes then something from the site and responds to it, but also exerts its your own power over the site or within yourself, I guess.
I think this idea that we're playing with of the interval is, if you can imagine that every space has like a timeline, and timeline kind of also is materialized by ideology. And the idea of the interval being, so for a split moment, you enter the timeline of that space and you shift it. And it's a moment, but basically neither you nor the space are the same ever again. And someone coming to it may not ever notice it. There's nothing to actually see or witness, but it's almost like this secret that you have through the entire process of filming is like you can't really tell who's being haunted and who's doing the haunting. And for the majority of the filming, it was like the site was very much haunting the body. And in this last kind of almost like liberation that kind of happened, the body finally haunts the site back.
There's also this part of the methodology we work with, which is sort of central, is this idea of a feminist utopia. The idea of the classic utopia of like Plato's and Thomas More's utopia of this walled-off island where everything is perfect and structured and built and nothing, no one has to escape and nothing ever has to change because it's perfect, which is sort of where we're standing, you know, this industrial utopia and like everything is going to be progress and prosperity. But then a feminist utopia being actually about a methodology or a process that is a way of working with unpredictability and a way of working with the alien that allows for this continuous evolution and allows for progress through the body and through becoming.
Comes through in that way. It's within my own practice, we produced a book called Beyond Utopia, which actually put forward the notion that utopia is a no place. So it's never intended to be actually realised.
Yes.
Hence why most of the time, or virtually all the time, it goes towards being dystopic in a way, these things are constructed.
Yes.
And so we put forward the idea that the utopia is actually the place, because it is originally a fiction, isn't it? Like, it's a story that someone recounts in an inn. And that utopia is actually about the act of imagining difference. And so it's about being in a contemporary moment and then acting or thinking something that is alternative to that. It thinks about the other or the solutions to the other. And so I think that really aligns with
yes.
what you're doing here in a way. Your act, I think that the work has got a complex richness to it, which imagines something different for the site, but it imagines something different for the body on the site. And I think our relationships with landscapes are something that I think are really evolving. And I think that this sort of exploration and in some ways celebration of the human will, in a way, is something that's really celebrated within the work.